So I'm glad to see there's one woman in the group, because I wanted to talk tonight from this book, The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. It's a collection of Zen stories from a woman's point of view, stories about women by women, which is rather unique. So much of the Zen tradition was down through monasteries and was from a rather male viewpoint. I don't want to set one against the other, but there are differences. And there have been times when I found it rather difficult to relate to what was going on in the stories, how things were handled. So I'm finding this book to be really wonderful and fascinating. So I wanted to read you one story, and then we'll talk about it. It's called Chiyono's No Water, No Moon, and it says it's from Japan, 13th century. Chiyono was a servant in a Zen convent who wanted to practice Zazen. One day she approached an elderly nun and asked, I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write and must work all the time. Is there any possibility that I could attain the way of Buddha, even though I have no skills?" The nun answered her, "This is wonderful, my dear. In Buddhism, there are no distinctions between people. There is only this. Each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. People are complete as they are. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being. There is only one complete nature. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. This is called Zazen." Chiyono said with happiness, "With this practice as my companion, I have only to go about my daily life practicing day and night." After months of wholehearted practice, she went out on a full moon night to draw some water from the well. The bottom of her old bucket, held together by bamboo strips, suddenly gave way, and the reflection of the moon vanished with the water. When she saw this, she attained great realization. Her enlightenment poem was this: "With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell." So let's go back and have a look a little more closely at parts of this. So here's Chiyono working in a Zen convent, but not taking part in it, in the practices there. And I suppose she's intrigued by what's going on all around her. She too wants a part of this, has perhaps many questions about her own life. But she's not sure that she has what it takes. But nevertheless, she steps forward and asks, a bold thing to do, I think, and wonderful that she did so. And she says, "Is there any possibility that I could attain the way of Buddha even though I have no skills?" I wonder what skills might she have thought was required that she couldn't read or write, would that hold her back, that she had to work all the time, had no leisure for Zazen, would that hold her back? Is the Dharma only for Zen students? This is a worthwhile point to ponder, I think, and something that's come up to me again and again, wondering about, is the practice of Zen really, is it only for middle-class educated people who can break a bit free of the culture in which they've been brought up and have the time, the leisure to come to places like this? Is it a practice that's so limited? And if it's not, how do we make it relevant for anyone? So Chiyono asks the same question. Is it relevant to me? Can even the likes of me touch the Dharma? So the nun answers her, and she says, in Buddhism, there are no distinctions between people. I think I would not have stated it quite that way, certainly not in 13th century Japan. Maybe we've, Buddhism always arises as a product of its culture or as an interaction with its culture. And perhaps we're a bit more egalitarian here and now than they were in 13th century Japan. But even so, I suspect there are some differences amongst people, as I just talked about, middle class, well-educated people versus, I don't know, high school dropouts. With no job. So perhaps it would be more accurate to say in the Dharma there are no distinctions between people. Let us say that instead. And then she says, there's only this, each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. So these are the two skills required. And they're not really skills, they're not something that needs to be attained or that one can learn in the sense of an education. Holding fast to the desire to awaken. Anyone can find this arising within them. And cultivating a heart of great compassion. She doesn't say you have to have a heart of great compassion, only to cultivate it. But the seeds are there for everyone. We need only prepare the field so that it can grow forth. And this is available to everyone. So it's not a special skill. This holding fast to the desire to awaken, this reminds me of, it puts me in mind of a sort of devotional practice, something that arises. Very much outside the realms of the mind, that is, of the thinking mind. And it reminds me of an article I read about, I'm pretty sure it was Mel Weitzman, I hope I don't have this wrong, who had just turned 80. And one of his senior students had solicited stories from any of his other students in the past or the present who would like to. Tell about their interactions with him. And then it was all written up, all of these stories, and put into a book to give to him for his 80th birthday. And so I read through several of them that were in the article. And generally they said more or less the same thing, that his talks were not particularly incisive. He didn't come across as particularly charismatic. If you wrote up his talks in a book, they'd be, okay. But he was so solid in his devotion to the practice. Every morning at 4:30, regardless, no matter what was going on, he was up and headed to the zendo. You could always count on him to be there. He would always meet you where you were in the Doksan room. And this steady heart of devotion that he brought forth, this desire to practice, to save all beings, and to awaken in his own life. This was what his students valued and what really reached them. No special skill, just practicing in his own way. So the nun is saying that this is true for Chiyono as well. And then she says, people are complete as they are. And I think it's a sort of universal way amongst humans that we think we do lack, that there's something essential that's missing, that we need to attain, that we need to somehow develop. And often we don't know what it is, but sometimes we'll put a name to it. Who knows? And I suppose this is what Chiyono was asking about when she said, I have no skills. Can I still manage this? Is there some way in for me? And it reminds me of, this was actually something that I brought up in the Ongo talk that I gave at the temple, so I hope nobody here heard that talk, because I'm going to say it again in a slightly different context. But when I was a kid, even back then, I was very interested in biology, or at least nature, which I defined as what was going on in the field next door or the woods across the street. And for my birthday one year, I don't know, maybe I was 10 or 12, something like that, my parents got me this this kit, and it was of a bullfrog. It's a plastic bullfrog, life-sized, and it had like all of its internal organs and bones that you could break off of the, you know, the plastic mold, and then you could hook them together in the correct sequence, one hopes, and then put it all into the two halves of the plastic skin, right? And it was transparent. It was a like green plastic that you could see through. So when you had it all together, you could see how all the organs fit together in the bones and everything. That was just fascinating. The only problem is that one of the organs was missing. And somehow in my mind, I remember it as being the pancreas. Who knows? But that's what I'll say, that it was a frog with no pancreas. And so when you put it together, you could see that it lacked a part. There was no way to hide it. Its skin was transparent and everyone could see it. And I've thought about that frog as a sort of metaphor for how I sometimes feel, that, you know, that there's something vital that I lack. Mm-hmm. And that everyone can see that it's true. There is no way to hide it. And yet, this bullfrog was complete. It was the whole thing right there. That's how he was, a bullfrog with no pancreas. Kind of like the koan about the non-attained Buddha. Mm-hmm. Is the non-pancreas frog, complete as non-pancreas. So people are complete as they are. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being. There is only one complete nature. So what are these delusive thoughts that we must not fall into? Which ones are the delusive ones and which ones are not? How do we divide them up? Or do we divide them up? Is there really any distinction to be made? Thoughts that arise, delusive. She's not saying that they shouldn't arise. She's not saying that there's anything wrong with them. She just said, don't fall into them. Let them come, let them go. One thought and then another. No need to judge if this one is delusive or that one isn't. They are actually all of a kind. So I noticed as I was walking down the street today, thinking about, you know, giving this talk tonight, that my mind was doing this habitual thing that it does and has done for as long as I can remember, and I think it's pretty certain that it'll continue to, which is that it makes up this little tune as I walk along. It's a completely, like maybe two notes, you know, up and down, different rhythm or whatever, really inane. But it seems to be happy to do that, to sort of fill in the gaps so that it knows where it is. And so I heard this little tune starting up, and I thought, oh, there it is again. This can't be good. You know, I need to find a way to stop this. You know, so second thought, first the tune, and then the thought, this is not good, I need to stop it. And then, wait, that's a thought too. So, you know, which is also another thought. And it goes on and on and on, right? Delusive thoughts, and not to fall into them. All of them of equal value in terms of Zazen practice. So we don't need to evaluate whether this one is acceptable. We don't need to decide what to do about it. We don't need to give instructions to ourselves. But if they arise, that's all right. We just don't fall into them. And if that's the case, if we're not differentiating, then how can there be Buddha and sentient being? Then there is only one complete nature. It might be the nature with no pancreas, but still complete. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. This is called Zazen. So often we hear about this turning toward, and here it is again. Must be something to it. Everybody says do it. And so when we are freed up from being dazzled by the context of our thoughts, by the content, rather, of our thoughts, some of them more interesting than others, when they begin to be all of a kind, that is, the delusive thoughts that arise in our minds, then it frees us up to turn and look at the root of the thoughts. We're no longer captured by them. We're not falling into them. And we can watch as they arise, the very moment, the first little urge that we feel of the thought breaking through into consciousness, to see where that arises from, to be there with it. And she says this is called Zazen. And then I really love it that Chiyono said, with happiness. Well then, with this practice as my companion, I only have to go about my daily life, practicing day and night. It seems like it was a relief to her. She doesn't have to add anything on. And I really think this is the wonderful part of the story, because, I mean, we all work day and night too. We all have our householder lives filled with the things of the world. And this need not interfere with practice at all. It is the practice. And this is a reminder for me. I find good news here, and reminding me that there's nothing that can get in the way of the practice. It's all of a piece. So after months of wholehearted practice, she doesn't say how many months. It could be a great many. And in fact, I looked around a bit on the internet to see if this story had showed up anywhere else. And it does. It's not a deeply unknown story. And in many of the versions of the story, she had practiced for years and years. So let us not be daunted by that word, months. After some unspecified amount of time of practice, she went out on a full moon night to draw some water from the well. And the bottom of her old bucket, held together by bamboo strips, suddenly gave way. And the reflection of the moon vanished with the water. So this bucket that's barely held together, it's been mended over and over. This bucket full of water that she's been carrying around with her for a long, long time, that holds the moon, nevertheless, begins to get more and more frayed as she practices. And yet, at some point, just can't hold together anymore. At some point there, deep in the moonlit night, it breaks through all the way. No need to hold it together anymore. Letting it go, letting the bottom drop out. And we do this, don't we? We build this scaffold that is ourselves. Our idea of ourselves, ourselves, and we mend it and maintain it so that we can carry our particular little puddle of moonlight. All of it, really, but our reflection of it around. And then as our practice proceeds, little by little, that scaffolding frays away. begins to break down, or we find that we don't really need it, don't always need it, and until the bottom breaks through. And I make it sound as though it's a process, but as I was sitting in the anteroom here this evening, before anybody came, I was paging through Dogen's Moon in a Dewdrop, and I came upon a quote where, his writing, he said, "As emancipation is not a matter of time, it is not concerned with the discussion of a certain moment or instant." So, not really a process. Not something where we have to strip away the old bucket straps little by little. Everything already done, really, just leaves for us to notice. And I think this refers also to our need to organize this life that is such a chaotic, changing place, this arising and moving and the shiftings of energy that our senses have to make a map of continually in order to allow us to maneuver through our life. And this is a kind of constant impromptu mending of the bucket as we reorder the map, as things change and we take note of it and we make new sense of it. I've heard it referred to as drawing eyebrows on the hurricane. This is a great moving thing, but I think it's right here. And then it moves some more. Wait, it was, you just can't keep up, it's hopeless. At some point, the bottom falls through and you realize, can't hold it together. No use even trying anymore. Sometimes life does that for us. I've noticed that there's a sort of a sine wave to our lives where for a time, everything is in place. Our job, our love life, our health, whatever, and it goes along and goes along. And then suddenly something shifts and everything falls apart and it has to be rebuilt again in a new way. And that lasts for a while. And then suddenly everything falls apart. And part of the liberation that comes from the Zen practice, at least in my experience, is that when those shifts happen, we don't insist on the eyebrows being in the same place on the hurricane. Yes? Hello?
Hi.
Come on in.
Anybody? Are there food?
No, not here. Maybe upstairs.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. But maybe we could use it. Wow, a hurricane. So there's this flexibility to meet whatever comes up. And sometimes that requires that there be a map, that the bucket hold together, and sometimes that we allow the water to fall through and disappear, and not hold on to it, not insist that it be there. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell.